in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Friday, July 11th, 2014. We've got two topics today. The Export-Import Bank. What is this thing? I'm sure you already know we don't need it, even if you don't know what it is. We obviously don't need it. But let's talk about what it is and why we don't need it. What are the fallacies embedded in it? And then I want to say a little something about the general question of austerity. We hear over and over again, it has been tried and it has failed. Well, has it been tried? Well, it depends on what you mean by austerity. Joining us to talk about these issues is Véronique Desrougies, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. She's a monthly columnist for the print edition of Reason Magazine and the Washington Examiner. And she blogs about economics at National Review Online's The Corner. She holds a PhD from the University of Paris, Sorbonne. Véronique, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Let's start off with a topic that some people may think is dull, and I don't know, maybe it is, but for the sake of completion, I want to cover it. There's been some talk in the media recently, and in our circles in particular, about something called the Export-Import Bank.
Yes.
First of all, what is the Export-Import Bank, and why now? Why is there so much commentary about it right now?
So the Export-Import Bank is a new era government agency that was created and that continues to basically dole out loans to foreign companies to buy American stuff, mostly Boeing products. And that's the reason why many of us call it the Boeing Bank. The reason why there's so many talks about it right now is because its reauthorization is coming up in September, and because somehow it seems that finally some Republicans in Congress have come to realize that it shouldn't exist. That it is. Even though it's a small agency that very few people have heard of, it is a quintessential illustration of everything that is wrong with corporate welfare, everything that is wrong with government intervening in capital markets, and everything that is wrong with political allocation of capital.
Well, you're right that there is this one company, Boeing, that we overwhelmingly associate with the Export-Import Bank. They are the ones who, more than everybody else put together, benefit from it.
Oh, but yeah, absolutely. So I mean, to give you an idea, all that Boeing is getting from EXIM are loan guaranteed. So foreign companies get loan guaranteed, so basically a really good deal to in exchange for buying Boeing goods. And of that part of the program, Boeing benefits 66% of the loan guaranteed extended go to benefit Boeing. But overall, the overall activity, over a third of the bank's activity goes to benefit Boeing. It's huge, but more importantly, some 75% of the bank activity goes to benefit only 10 giant companies. And you would, you know, people say, "Wow, why?" But yeah. It's a very good question. Why? Especially considering that the foreign buyers, for the most part, are either people who really shouldn't be getting access to capital or companies who actually have full access to capital and are just getting a super sweet, sweet deal. And while in good times, it doesn't cost us that much. In fact, it may even be returning money to Treasury, which isn't clear, but let's assume it is. So taxpayers' exposure is gigantic. It's like there's over $140 billion of liability that could fall on our laps, or part of it could fall on our laps during hard times.
What a company like Boeing might come back with against you, though, is to say that other countries are going to be giving special benefits to their companies. So we're just trying to level the playing field here, and you free market ideologues are going to make it completely impossible for us to compete.
Well, I mean, yes, they say this all the time, but okay, so there are two main reasons why this argument doesn't hold water. The first one is that when you hear this type of argument, you would think that all that the bank does is to counteract these foreign subsidies. Well, when you look at how the bank actually justifies its activity, only a third of what it does goes to doing this, to level the playing field. I mean, I hate using this word in the case of government, but against foreign subsidies. So 70% of what the bank does has nothing to do with this. And then the other thing is, like, we have 200 years of economic literature that tells us that protectionism, which is what XM does, is bad even when other countries are doing it. In other words, that it is in the U.S.'s interest to stop subsidizing exporters, only a handful of exporters, right? Even if other countries don't do, because when we subsidize exporters, sure, their bottom lines, this few ones who are doing this, are their bottom lines are getting padded and is improving. But there's a gigantic cost to U.S. consumers, to other U.S. companies who aren't getting these type of benefits. And these costs to these unseen victims is overwhelmingly bigger than the teeny benefit that the well-connected companies are getting from these political privilege.
Why would the Export-Import Bank continue if overwhelmingly the benefits accrue to just one company? Is Boeing really giving that much money to the politicians?
Well, yes. And the other thing is, like, you know that story, Tom. It's a typical public choice story. The beneficiary of the Export-Import Bank are very visible. They're very big. They're very loud. They're very well connected. They have a lot of money, so they can put a lot of pressure on politicians. The victims, on the other hand, are spread out throughout the U.S. Often they pay a price and they can't really realize, don't really realize why it is, for instance, that plane tickets are so expensive. Or they don't even know that they actually, without the Export-Import Bank, their plane tickets would be less expensive. They don't know that, you know, that the guy who gets laid off doesn't necessarily make connection that the reason why he got laid off is because a competitor company is actually getting a handout from the government and making the environment they competed just totally unfair, to the point that he has to lay off his employees. And so the unseen, all the victims throughout, or even the few who realize that they are getting screwed basically by government intervention, they're not represented in Washington. They don't have lobbyists lobbying for them. They don't have access to a press office. And so this is the reason why it continues.
All right, let's shift now to the subject of austerity, which you've written about. First of all, tell us what your definition of austerity would be and what the definition of austerity that, let's say, Paul Krugman uses, or that is used in a lot of other situations to make it seem like we've actually had austerity when maybe we have not. And when I say we, I mean the whole Western world.
Well, actually, there's three definitions I'm going to give you. I'm going to give you mine, okay, which I suspect is your definition of austerity. The only true austerity that we want to see is one where the size of government goes down. Basically, it's cutting spending. That's what austerity means. When you're in the red with your family, that's what you do is you cut your expenses, rather than actually necessarily try to bully your boss to give you a higher pay. So that would be my definition of austerity. Unfortunately, the way austerity is defined in the economic literature and the way people talk about it is any attempt to reduce our debt-to-GDP ratio. Mm. And that can be achieved by reducing spending, increasing taxes, or doing a mix of both.
Right.
And what Krugman has been doing, and a lot of the people who've been talking about austerity, is assuming that any of the attempts that have been put in place in Europe or anywhere else has actually taken the form of reducing spending, when in fact, when you look at the data, what most of them have done is raise taxes.
And you have looked at the data. I mean, you've compiled some information on this. And what was it that you found? What conclusion did you draw? Is it
So for instance, looking at European countries, right, one of the things that you see is that a vast majority of them have implemented fiscal adjustment packages that are mostly based on tax increases and not at all on spending cuts. In fact, spending has continued to go up, and when it hasn't, what it has has grown a little slower than it used to in the past, which is hardly what you and I would call austerity.
Right.
And we know that this is absolutely the wrong way to approach reducing the debt and growing your economy. We have like 25 years of economic literature. We have a lot of empirical work that shows best way to reduce your debt to GDP ratio in the short term and obviously the long term is to adopt austerity packages that are made of spending cuts. And which type of spending cuts? Mostly what in America we would call entitlement spending, and also the size and pay of government.
Now, of course, there isn't going to be any government out there whose policies are going to satisfy us completely, but just looking around the world, who has done the relatively best job, and how is that, or how are those economies doing?
So I think, as you say, I mean, no country is pure at all, and the way none of them are really doing what you and I would like them to do, and it's not just because it's our preference. Again, it's because it's sound economics, but the Swedes, strangely, have actually been pretty good. They've cut spending. They reduced taxes in some areas. They also have done because they're not part of the EU. They've done pretty sound monetary policy. They've also liberalized to some extent their labor market instead of doing and so they have done really a much better job, and it's paid off. On the other hand, if you want me to tell you who is one of the countries who's done exactly who is our role model for what not to do, I will tell you, the French. I mean, obviously, not a surprise. They've raised taxes. I mean, it is quite astonishing that we continue raising taxes and raising taxes and raising taxes and not get. This is why your country is actually shrinking.
Yeah. Now, you are are you a French national?
Yeah. I'm also an American, but yes, I am French.
So this is particularly a difficult pill to swallow, although I suppose France has been on a path like this for quite some time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it would be a tough pill to swallow if I hadn't given up on France a long time ago. But in fact, I find France, you know, really useful in a sense as a always kind of you need to have a country that you can always point to as like, look what the government does. Look what happens, you know, when you increase taxes like this all of the time. So it is really stunning how they've been wrong. Their instincts are always wrong, and their policies are just really have devastating effects.
Now, when you came out with your data on austerity, you got attacked by Paul Krugman. What was his problem?
Well, his problem was just like he actually when he attacked me, yeah, several times, and he wasn't alone. I mean, there were a lot of attacks on me, but Krugman was actually the least constructive one because he would just like drop my name in the middle of a blog post saying that when are people going to understand that she's just a hack? And he wouldn't even like point to my work or say what was wrong with my work but the bottom line is he was really, really annoyed at me pointing out that these European countries, to the extent that they implemented austerity, they didn't implement public austerity in the form of cutting spending. They implemented private austerity in the form of high taxes. But you know what? For all his screaming and yelling and calling us names, in the end, I've noticed that he started actually acknowledging that, you know, Europeans have raised taxes. He started actually addressing the tax issue. Because one of the things I kept saying is how is it possible that those hardcore Keynesians, like Paul Krugman and a lot of other people, are not outraged at what's going on in Europe? Because, as you know, the Keynesian theory tells you that in time of recession, you need, yes, to increase spending. I don't buy that, but you need to increase spending and you need to cut taxes. And certainly you shouldn't be raising taxes. That's really bad. The Keynesian theory tells you this. So they should be totally outraged about what the Europeans were doing. They should actually have been the first one writing editorials bashing the Europeans for their policies. They didn't.
No, I agree. And I think it's because egalitarianism trumps the pure theory of Keynesianism, but that's just a theory of my own.
Or politics. You know, I mean, it is quite astonishing to look at how people are willing to change their position or overlook what they claim they believe in just in the name of when it's convenient politically. I mean, you see this in exempt that we just talked about, where the Democrats used to be totally against the exempt, the import-export bank, because it's corporate welfare, and now they're all for it. They're carrying water for big corporation, and suddenly they've forgotten that they were against it for decades.
I had somebody comment on my blog just the other day that Krugman, after all, is an award-winning economist and very smart, and everything he has predicted has come true. And now, I don't know about all his predictions. I'm sure Bob Murphy has got them all memorized. But what I do know is that if you say we need to lower interest rates to spur housing, and then you turn around and say, you know, I think there might be a housing bubble brewing, well, I don't think that's such a feather in your cap, given that you called for the very conditions that made a housing bubble inevitable. Turning around and predicting it really isn't all that impressive.
No, I agree with you. And the other thing is that he does is that he changed the he changes the goal as he goes along. It's kind of like at first it was, if you remember during the stimulus phase, right? It was like the administration had said unemployment was going to go up above 8.8% if we didn't pass the stimulus. Well, when that turned out to not be true, suddenly no one was talking about that prediction, and they had moved the dialogue somewhere else.
Well, yeah, because what did happen was we did get the stimulus. And unemployment went even higher than they said it would have gone without the stimulus. So, of course,
yeah,
they have to run away.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. So, it is, I don't know whether, I mean, I hate to actually make assumptions about what people do and why they do it. But I will say, and I've said that to some of my liberal critics, that I don't want to be walking around saying things that are not true, right? And everyone makes mistakes, but when they actually show me that I've made an argument in a way that's like sloppy or that I've said something that's not true, you know, I will stop doing it. And also, I try to be consistent in the case I make for freedom. I really try to. And I see that the other side doesn't have some standard of intellectual honesty. It's just not necessarily present, let's put it this way.
How can people follow you online? Is there an easy way to do so?
Yes. I work for the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. So if you go on the Mercatus website, which is mercatus.org, you can find me. I'm on Twitter at Vero De Rugy, VeroDerugy. And I blog at The Corner at National Review.
Okay, so Mercatus, MERCATUS.org. Well, Veronique, we have never spoken before, but I've followed your work for some time, and I'm glad to have a chance to talk with you. I hope we can do it again sometime.
I would love to write back at you. As soon as I heard, when you guys contacted me, I was just, oh, of course, I would love to.
Oh, that's wonderful. We appreciate getting that kind of response from a potential guest. Well, thanks so much again for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
All right, before I let you guys go for the weekend, I want to preview with you what we're doing next week. Next week, we are going to be talking to Joshua Hall, who's a professor of economics and the editor of a new book, Homer Economicus, The Simpsons and Economics. Homer Economicus? That is such a great title. And it's a bunch of chapters on all different aspects of economics as they are illustrated by The Simpsons. So that's going to be a lot of fun. I mean, talk about a great gift idea, right? I mean, that's a way to take somebody who has no interest in this stuff and convert them just on the basis of their love for The Simpsons. Wonderful. Great idea. We're going to talk to Bob Murphy, who's going to bring us up to date on the Fed and what it claims its forthcoming policy will be. Then Jason Jewell will join us. Jason is a contributor to a wonderful new book on the general subject of social justice. But the interesting thing about this book is they take five people with five completely different views of social justice. Each one writes a chapter, and then each one of the other ones comments on that one's chapter. Fascinating. I've never seen a book organized like this, but wow, what a punchy read. And Jason does our point of view real justice in that book. Then we've got, I'm telling you, you're going to love this one. Haven't talked to him yet, but I know the guy well enough to tell you you're going to love this one. Charles Calamiris of Columbia Business School will join us to talk about banks and bank crises and why the truth is the opposite of what you read in the mainstream press. Fascinating and great. He has a brand new book out from Princeton University Press, Fragile by Design, on the political origins of banking crises. Then finally, Philip Hamburger of Columbia Law School will join us to talk about his new book, Is Administrative Law Unlawful? So a lot of great stuff coming up next week, so make sure you don't miss it. I'm still working on that new book. I've got, I would say I probably got 2 solid weeks of work left to go on it, just about that. I don't have 2 solid weeks coming up because I've got to go out of town for a few days and I've got the Mises University summer program coming up, but I feel good about it and I've chosen a title. It's not any of the submitted titles, although I look through every single one. I look through the entire Facebook thread. I look through the thread on my blog. I appreciate the contributions you guys made, the suggestions. A lot of them were attractive to me. I did like Beware Citizen, like that. That was good, with a good subtitle, but I feared that that only works with people who already know my shtick, and although I am going to pitch this book primarily to people who know me already and don't need to be sold on who I am and stuff, still I thought it should be a little clearer. I think I'm a little too shy to tell you what I've decided on. I find it hard to take criticism in areas that I know I stink at. You would think that would be where you could take criticism the easiest, but I'm so sensitive about what a rotten title guy I am that I think I'm afraid to tell you what I decided on. But my wife, who is not a yes woman, by the way, she will tell me if I do something that stinks. she says it's very good and it would actually make her pick it up and read it. So we'll see. Maybe I'll have the guts, the courage to tell you what it is next week. But everybody who supports the show at supportinglisteners.com will get that ebook for nothing, or at least at no extra cost. For as little as five smackers a month, you can get transcripts of the show, plus discounts around the internet, discounts at the Mises store, 60% off at libertyclassroom.com. It's a cool thing to do because it makes me feel good and it lets me promote the show and, of course, pay for the transcriptionist, needless to say. So I appreciate you guys supporting me. All kinds of goodies are going to be added to that program in the coming months. I've got to just finish this book. That'll be a goodie that you guys will get. And, of course, you'll also get the audio book. Support the show if you like what I'm doing. Supportinglisteners.com is where you can do that. Thanks for listening, everybody. Lots of fun stuff next week. And I'm telling you, if you don't like The Simpsons, you have the weekend to go to YouTube and watch some clips and change your mind. But definitely join us for our chat with Joshua Hall coming up on Monday. Thanks, everybody. See you then.
The Tom Woods Show.